This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the U.S., and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KBF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org. A podcast will be available to the show on Monday at that website, as well as at www.affiliatedmedia.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Maxwell Cherardello, who's the Research and Communications Director. He'll get me right here. Public Policy and Communications Director at the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing and Action Center.
That's right.
Not bad. Welcome to Wade's World, Max.
Thank you for having me.
So I reached out to you because there's an issue that's happening all over the country, but more recently, right here in New Orleans, you've been in the papers and part of a fight that has to do with building public housing.
Yeah, that's right. And so this is actually rare these days.
Absolutely, that's why I'm so excited. Yeah.
It's rare that we actually build new public housing.
And that versus, of course, 30 years of policy just to even try to rebuild it.
Right. So we've seen, you know, public policy at the federal level try and defund public housing for the past half century almost. And here in New Orleans, we saw almost all of our public housing demolished and then rebuilt as mixed-income housing, lot less units. And so we saw an opportunity here. The Housing Authority still owns a lot of vacant land. A lot of it is, or at least a good chunk of it, is still in neighborhoods now that are close to jobs, that are actually becoming pretty exclusive, that have gentrified and are really expensive now. It's sort of ideal spot for affordable housing. This particular lot we've been talking about in New Orleans lately is in the Bywater neighborhood, which is one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the city now. Certainly wasn't before Hurricane Katrina.
We'll get into that. I can swear to the details here.
Yeah. And so there has been, the Housing Authority is proposing to build 150 units on the site. 90 of them would be affordable. And there's been some neighborhood opposition, and it's been an interesting conversation.
Well, that's the most polite thing I've heard to say about, you know, the conversation. So this was actually, Hano is the Housing Authority in New Orleans. This was Hano property previously.
That's right. They've owned the property for a long time.
And they had units here up until fairly recently, certainly within the last maybe 5 years.
I'm not sure they were ever reoccupied after the storm, but there were about 30 units on that site before the storm. And then they were demolished in 2015. And Hano actually had a plan to sell that land. And it was only under the new director that they decided to keep hold of it and actually rebuild on it.
Now, there was a hearing recently in the Planning Commission, and for a change, the New Orleans Planning Commission is saying, okay, let's build.
Yeah, that was a really positive decision, and it was a good conversation, I think. But we were a little nervous going in because there has been some significant opposition from some neighborhood groups here.
I had a leader back in Arkansas in the early 70s when I first was organizing ACORN, named Bill Whipple. And he used to have an expression. He'd say, Wade, do you know what the definition of a rationale is? And I'd say, Bill, what is that? It's just a lie in the skin of a reason. And that's always stuck with me, Maxwell. What was the rationale for some of the opposition?
Sure.
God knows we need more affordable housing. God knows public housing.
Right.
How could anybody oppose this?
Well, let me set the table first, because I think, you know, neighborhood associations generally, certainly in New Orleans, that's where I know them best, but I've lived in plenty of other cities, are generally comprised of more affluent homeowners. And in New Orleans, they have regularly opposed mixed-income developments. And they've succeeded in killing or downsizing a number of them. Two of them, you know, on this side of town, the Bywater Arts Lofts and the Aloysius Apartments were downsized because of neighborhood opposition. There was one that was killed in the Lower Garden District, and there have been plenty of others. The city got sued over one of them on Esplanade, and eventually that got built. So this is sort of par for the course here, but it's also a common thing across the country. We see where as neighborhoods gentrify and they gain white residents in particular, those residents often are hostile to affordable housing, even though that may have been, you know, the neighborhood may have been affordable before they got there. And this actually can help folks return who used to live there. So that's a trend we're seeing across the country and across New Orleans. So it wasn't necessarily a surprise here. But you're right. There are still a lot of people in the neighborhood and people on the City Planning Commission who understand that the Bywater needs affordable housing, that New Orleans in general needs affordable housing, but we absolutely need it on land that doesn't flood, is close to jobs, already has access to resources like public transit, grocery stores, etc.
Part of the rationale that I heard from some of the opponents was that they wanted to reduce the footprint of the affordable units because of green space.
Sure, we hear green space, we hear density, traffic, parking, but ultimately the result is the same, which is that this sort of opposition either downsizes or kills these projects, and neighborhoods end up more exclusive and more segregated.
Well, I just want to point out, for the listeners who obviously don't live here in New Orleans, we're talking about an area that actually Maxwell and I are only about maybe two and a half miles away from this site at the longest. And it's right next to a huge project that was partially subsidized by community development block grant funds, which are designated for lower income families, mm-hmm. called the Crescent Park,
yeah.
Which runs along the Mississippi River and has what I would call green space galore.
It does. And a dog park, which is
one
of the other concerns.
And a dog park, for goodness sake. So, yeah. I think the poor souls over there would probably have to walk, I don't know, would it be two blocks to get
if
there?
That,
I mean,
yeah.
It wouldn't stretch you, let's just say this, and there's bikes and whatever. So really, the only way to understand this is just that it was anti-poor and anti-affordable housing.
I mean, that's our concern, certainly.
More elegantly spoken than I am. Absolutely, because I warned Maxwell, he reached out, and I said, you know, if I was in town, I'd be glad to come. Here's the only problem. I'd want to argue for even more density.
I would
have said, oh, God, you know, let's move that up a couple floors. Let's see if we can get 250, you know, 300 units there.
Right.
Because green space, that's preposterous. I mean, I'm offended that there are 60... you know, market rate apartments in there. I mean, but that's me, and luckily I wasn't there to, you know, Maxwell won on this particular fight. I might have, you know, thrown some, you know, a fly in the ointment here. But.
No, we'd welcome you there and others with your views. I think that's actually an important point, which is that, you know, I think similarly, our advocacy is for as many affordable units as possible. I think most of us on this side of it would like to see all those units be deeply affordable. And honestly, I think the position that Hanno is coming with is already somewhat of a compromised position.
I would absolutely say that's correct.
But also, you know, we realize sort of the reality we're working with, which is that Hanno doesn't have any money to build these units. They've got land, and they've got, you know, some subsidies they can offer to help cover the rent for some of the tenants, but that's all they can bring to the deal. And so, you know, it's a neoliberal solution, but it's sort of the one on the table, which is that they partner with a private developer and they help, you know, subsidize the project by having some market rate units. And like I said, it's not how I would prefer to do it, but we're going to take as many affordable units as we can get.
Absolutely. And this obviously is not something that is New Orleans based. This is a federal policy.
Right. Absolutely.
Because the funds in HUD, and of course we don't want to get too far into what HUD Secretary Carson might think about all this kind of stuff, but there isn't the money that's been available for decades now to really rebuild the stock of public housing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we're working with ever-decreasing public funds for affordable housing across the board, so we're trying to get creative. And leveraging the land, the publicly owned land that we have, is one of the best things we can do.
This particular site is, as Maxwell said, is on high ground, coming off the Mississippi River. The land over there is almost 8 to 9 feet above sea level because you're in the alluvial floodplain of the Mississippi River. If you go over there, the river is 150 to 175 feet deep. But
right.
Where this is did not flood. And, you know, I happen to live in the same neighborhood that we're talking about, in the office where the studio is here, is not far from it as well. So before the storm, before Katrina, the neighborhood for years had been two-thirds or more African-American. Let's just say it this way. It only been a 30% white.
I ran the stats on it the other day. It's
70% black and brown. Mm-hmm. So when I first moved into the neighborhood permanently in 1979, 1980, that was the neighborhood, working-class neighborhood. It was all I could afford. I was, you know, had just been living in Little Rock, coming back to New Orleans. Now, 10 years after Katrina, it totally flipped.
Two-thirds white. About 29, 30% black.
So that's preposterous. And clearly, it's also a situation of cost. The particular house I live in, you know, I paid in 1979 less than $88,000, something like that. I don't know if you could get a garage for $88,000 in Bywater anymore. And the tax bill I pay now is, you know, based on an evaluation almost five times of what I paid. So I feel like I'm almost lucky to hang in the neighborhood myself. So no,
yeah.
This is we're talking about this not because this is what Maxwell's campaign has been or where I live and where I'm supporting what he's done, but because this is sort of a little microcosm of sort of the crisis in gentrification, not only in New Orleans, but all over the country, isn't it, Maxwell?
Yeah, it's true. We're seeing this in cities across the country. And honestly, you know, the only difference in New Orleans is that it sort of hit us all at once, whereas in, you know, New York, D.C., and plenty of other cities across the country, this is something that maybe started in the mid-90s and has been just getting worse and worse. And a lot of the cities now are almost off limits to anyone who's not affluent and wealthy.
Seattle, San Francisco, these are executive cities.
Exactly.
If you're not, I mean, when you have Vancouver, if you're not prepared to pay $1 million plus, and in San Francisco, I don't know if you can get something there, you can't live there.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And so the only difference, I think, is that in New Orleans, this sort of all came right after the storm. Rents doubled and tripled immediately. And then we saw them level off a little bit around 2008, 2009, 2010, 11. And then starting in about 2011, they started going up again. And so we've seen like 25-30% increases since then in rents. It's been really significant. The other piece about New Orleans is that it's really two separate housing markets. You've got Bywater, the Lower Garden District, these areas that are on high ground that have historic housing stock.
Marin East, sir.
Right, that are adjacent, that were adjacent to white neighborhoods, even if they had been majority black. Those have gentrified almost completely. And then you've got areas in New Orleans East and the Lower Ninth Ward, Holly Grove, and other parts of the city that haven't seen any of that investment. Most of them had been redlined, you know, in the 30s, so there has been no investment since then, and they're still struggling. So
Acorn has a half-acre farm now in the Lower Ninth Ward where the organization used to have several thousand members. So it's there's tragic. We have somebody we can blame, clearly, and that has to do with the weather and the storm and whatever, but we're talking to Maxwell Schiardelli, who's the Public Policy and Communications Director for the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing and Action Center. Maxwell, there was an article right on in time with this in the New York Times this last weekend. You probably saw it. It's a similar fight. People are trying to argue against building a high-rise near the Botanical Garden in New York City. A high-rise, obviously, would have a lot more affordable units, and the argument is once again green space versus affordable housing. This is becoming common. It's not just there.
No.
But the author of the article had some interesting. Did you happen to see this piece?
I didn't know.
But so the argument, as best they could say, was that some of the plants might not get as much sun if you put the units up that size, so they were arguing for something much smaller. And she had a number of suggestions about how they could get climate impacting green impacts without changing the nature of that affordable housing policy. And that was creative, I thought.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, it makes you wonder how serious some of the green concerns are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's worthwhile to think about how we get creative, and I'm sure there's some smart landscape architects who can think through that. But I find it really interesting that public officials and elected leaders don't ever really seem to consider, or haven't ever really seemed to consider, you know, green space concerns when these neighborhoods were low income and majority people of color. Now, all of a sudden, that there's white people there who want green space, this becomes a concern. And it just happens to coincide with, you know, being pitted against affordable housing. So I find that I'm a little skeptical of that. And I think it's, you know, we're talking about this a lot in the Bywater, but, you know, about a month ago, we had a resolution over a city-owned lot not a mile and a half away from it on Esplanade and Henriette DeLille that the city has been put out to bid for affordable housing, as we have advocated for them to do, and nearby neighbors said, no, wait, we want a playground and a dog park. And again, this is a neighborhood that, sure, when it was, you know, 20 years ago, it might have been a low-income neighborhood, and then maybe advocating for new resources in that neighborhood, like, you know, a park and a playground might have made sense. But now it is one of the most expensive parts of the city. It's a block away from the French Quarter, and now you want to talk about parks and playgrounds, as you know, so many of the neighborhoods.
That lot's been vacant for years.
That's right.
This is, you know, to finally have a real proposal.
Right.
I mean, this is absurd. But you know, I don't know. Obviously, the Fair Housing Center here is probably connected to Fair Housing Centers all around the country. So,
yeah.
Maxwell was telling me before we started, he's been in this particular job for the last 5 years. I'm sure you've been to conferences and you're hearing people tear their hair everywhere. Is any city doing more on this issue? I mean, are there any bright spots we can look at? I mean,
no, there are definitely. There are. I think nationally, there's starting to be something of an understanding that housing and where you live is intricately connected to health outcomes, how long you live, even, and all sorts of other
Key health outcomes.
Yeah, maybe the most important. Income, all sorts of other pieces of people's life outcomes. And so there are cities that are taking this seriously. So I know that Oregon just passed some really amazing laws. One of them, I think, is essentially rent control, allowing some rent control. Another one to prevent evictions without cause. We saw Minneapolis recently did away with single-family zoning. So you can't, I think throughout the city of Minneapolis now, every lot has to allow for at least 3 units. And of course, single-family zoning
is very important.
Yeah, it's historically one of the ways that neighborhoods have stayed segregated is by ensuring that the only way you can buy into a neighborhood is you have to buy a large lot and build a big home on it. That certainly keeps people out. So yeah, I think there are cities that are doing innovative things. And I would say in New Orleans, we're starting to. We're behind, but we've seen more attention on housing issues at this city council than we have in since I've been doing this work in the past 5 years.
The councilman in this very district was arguing for like 50 units, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so Councilmember Kristen Palmer, who has been an ally on other housing issues, I think still needs some convincing on this particular lot. And so that's something that we want to make sure that she knows, that there are a lot of neighbors who really want to see affordability, who want to see a diverse and open neighborhood.
You just have to wonder if this is a homeowners versus everybody else kinds of thing, because she's been leading the fight against Airbnb, protecting jealously, you know, interests of private homeowners, even though ignoring the fact that commercial Airbnbs are going to go crazy with this new ordinance. And yet, here she is, curiously saying, you know, let's have less units as opposed to more affordable units. I mean, it makes me very suspicious of her position. I mean, let me go back to Oregon, though. That's an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
It did seem huge that Oregon went forward on a statewide rent control. I mean, there are city rent controls, but I don't know if you really had a chance to look at the details. Those numbers were pretty, you know, you can raise the rent 8%.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
that's significant.
This is like, it was sort of, as I read the article and talked to people out there, I was sort of like, my hair was burning. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a victory. I wanted to, you know, make sure we got, you know, interviewed somebody on the radio and did a blog about it. And then it was sort of like biting my lip time, because Where we fought for rent control, particularly in places like Scotland and elsewhere, where we've won area caps, you know, we've had problems getting the areas defined, but then you've got a hard cap, right? 8%, and then, you know, something else that has to do with the inflation rate. I mean, you could literally in Oregon see rent still go up 10, 12, 13%, depending on what's happening. And that, there's no way a lower income working family is going to survive living in Portland if all of a sudden their rent in 2 or 3 years goes up by 40%.
Sure.
So what in the world? I mean, this is like even our victories, we have to say, where's there's a huge donut hole in the middle of them before we, you know, get the high horse. And the way it feels like you're interviewing me now. I better watch out. I'm losing control of this interview. Usually, as listeners know, I'm much better at letting people, but these new enterprise zones that developers are taking over from the new tax thing, that's another concern. It's got to be for you as well. That's been in the papers here in New Orleans, and there's an ugly face to it. Why don't you explain how that's going to work?
Sure. Well, I'll do my best. Honestly, there's parts of it
you.
That...
I'm going to help you.
Okay, because there's parts of it that I still don't fully understand.
You're not supposed to understand the 2017 tax law.
Right. No, that's
so
right.
We're right on time, Maxwell.
Right. So this is an idea pioneered by Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, and I believe Cory Booker of New Jersey has also been a part of it. And the idea is to give tax breaks on capital gains taxes to folks who put their money in newly created funds that will help support projects, and we're not sure of what kind, in specially designated enterprise zones. And then each state can sort of set aside what census tracts those are.
Theoretically, to benefit lower income families.
That's right. Theoretically, right. These are lower income census tracts.
And so that increase jobs, housing opportunities, et cetera.
Right. But there's very few rules about what exactly you can invest in. So from a fair housing standpoint, if there's investment going into, say, New Orleans East, parts of New Orleans East that are lower income, that could be a good thing. Or into North Baton Rouge. That could be a good thing. If it creates good jobs for folks, that would be great. If it creates housing for people, that would be great. But if it creates more polluting, health hazard, refineries, that wouldn't be great.
How about hotels along the river?
Right. Well, and that's the other thing, is that some of those census tracts...
I mean, there is nothing in this tax law, the special enterprise zone, that actually enforces that it benefit any low-income families.
No, that's true.
It's even worse than CDBG. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, we're going to get you to an enterprise zone, you're going to have some designated, and then it's like the whole central business district of Baton Rouge is an enterprise zone.
That's right. And there are some census tracts here that if they're not, well, I believe the Lower Garden District is included, but then there are some that are right on the edge of sort of gentrified neighborhoods, and that's the other thing.
They say that you can get a zone if you're contingent to a low income.
Yeah, if you're right next to it. That's right.
So we're already, the Swiss cheese here is already daunting, so this is going to be a real estate developer's program. It's not going to be.
It could be.
Let's just say I'm skeptical that this is going to.
No, we are too, and I'm not. Like I said, you know, I think this is going to depend a lot on who sets up the funds and what they choose to fund, because I don't think there's a lot of rails on the program, a lot of guardrails. So, yeah, we're concerned.
There's no accountability enforcement in this. I mean, this was an idea from Sean Parker, the Napster Facebook guy, and his little institute, and he, you know, passed it on to some of these senators, and bam, we have something. I'm sure many of them are well-intentioned, but when you leave it wide open, we've got enough experience back to UDAG grants in the 70s and 80s going forward, where supposedly it's supposed to benefit lower-income families, and it just doesn't do that. It just is another tax exemption. Furthermore, on this one, if you hold it, the properties, if you hold your investment for 10 years, you don't have to ever take any capital gains. So it's one of those gifts that just keeps on giving. Where were we when Christmas came to Congress? Here we are back in New Orleans still sweating about this. So the The New Orleans Fair Housing Center has been active for a long time here in trying to make sure that rentals didn't discriminate. I mean, mm-hmm. We're going to move on to some of the other
sure.
programs y'all have been involved in. Is there progress on these issues in terms of racial discrimination, discrimination against disabled and others in rental stock or in other things?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, right, the Fair Housing Center was founded in 1995 to fight discrimination and segregation, and so that is something we've been doing for the past 24 years, is responding to folks who come to us with complaints, who think they may have been discriminated against. And then we also do regular testing, and by that I mean that we send out equally paired mystery shoppers. So if we're testing for racial discrimination, we'll send out an equally paired white and black renter who speak to the same realtor or landlord, and then we sort of chronicle whether their experiences were any different and if there was any discriminatory treatment there. And what we found is that pretty consistently, about half of the time, our black testers are treated differently. Treated worse, to be clear. We also, the top three basis for complaints that we receive are race, disability, and then family status, and that's for people who have children who are being discriminated against. We saw a lot of that after the storm. Folks saying, you know, they didn't want to rent to children or to people with children. We actually, as part of our response to that, we actually wrote a children's book about fair housing discrimination and use that in classrooms across the city and then actually across the country. There are folks who use it in their curriculum to try and make sure that families understand. I mean, part of the problem is that folks don't even know these things are necessarily against the law. And so we need to do some education in addition to the enforcement.
And some of this triggered lawsuits.
Yes, absolutely. We do that too. We certainly start with education, but we do not hesitate to file a lawsuit if one needs
Sometimes
to be filed.
Sometimes you got to give them the fist, not the glove.
That's right.
We've been talking to Maxwell about the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center. Is there any way, if people have more questions, see these problems in their cities, there's a wide audience for this particular show, who can they get in touch with? Local fair housing centers, or back to you, Maxwell, or
yep.
website, or how can I send you some love or money or whatever? Let's tell some people how to do that.
Absolutely. So the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center, you can find us online at gnofairhousing.org, and our Facebook is GNO Fair Housing as well. If you're in the city and you're interested in getting involved in this particular issue around the lot and the bywater, message us on Facebook. It's GNO Fair Housing again.
Because this may go to the city council still.
It will, yeah. We'll have to go to the city council.
We need to have a celebratory march before we've got this thing
That's
nailed
right.
down. So
That's right.
We may have to come back again. But go ahead, Maxwell.
Yeah, and then if you're outside of, we serve the whole state. So if you're in Louisiana, you can contact us. If you're outside Louisiana, you can use the National Fair Housing Alliance to find the closest fair housing center to you. That's nationalfairhousing.org.
They're located in D.C. Yeah.
They are, yep. But there's not a fair housing center in every state, but there's one in most. So there's somebody who serves you somewhere.
Absolutely. So we've been lucky to be talking about this. This is an ongoing subject that we keep covering on Wage World here. Gentrification, affordable housing, they're not building enough, as Maxwell says. The rents are going through the sky. We could talk about that forever. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen, you'll never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wage World.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, a grassroots effort to produce public radio news and information serving the needs of low and moderate income working Americans by providing a platform for voices not commonly heard in mainstream media. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.